Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
And Vanity Fair's film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And all the way from the West Coast, Vanity Fair senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hello.
So this week, it's in the wake of a pretty dismal opening box office for The Birth of a Nation, which was a huge Sundance purchase. It was a big deal and then became plagued by scandal surrounding its star and director, Nate Parker. Box office isn't always Oscar fate, but in this case, it seems to be. So we'll talk about what the fate of this movie is and maybe lessons we can learn from it. And then from there, we're going to look at the Best Actress race. We've all seen some films at various festivals that have us talking about who might win that statue. For some reason, Best Actress is one of the most fun categories to talk about every year. And this year, it's looking like a really good lineup. Finally, we'll put on our prediction caps and look at the Best Supporting Actress category as well.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So, Birth of a Nation. Richard, you saw this at Sundance. You were there for the hype and the craziness and the huge ticket sale. Was it the kind of thing where when you spend $17 million on a movie at Sundance, like it was almost destined not to reach its expectations regardless of what happened after?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. There's actually an interesting article on Vox.com right now about, it's kind of a critic wrestling with her experience of being at the premiere and then kind of looking at the movie now 10 months later and being like, kind of reading her review from Sundance and being like, oh, did I kind of get this wrong? And I kind of did the same thing. But at that time, yeah, it felt like this inevitable hit. But then there always is at Sundance in particular, over the festivals, that little creeping kind of thing underneath it that like, oh, is this all just festival fever? And I think I had that less for this movie, but it was certainly there, you know.
Yeah. Well, and when this movie came out, we talked about it on the podcast. It was like a week after the Oscar nominations had come out, the Oscars So White hashtag had really taken off. Yeah. And the whole idea of a really prestige movie with a black director and a black cast was so appealing that it really felt like, regardless of if it was as good as people were saying, it was going to be important and discussed.
Mm-hmm. I saw it, you know, at sea level here in a screening, and I talked about it on the podcast. I actually think it's a very powerful, if somewhat flawed, film. Somebody in The New Yorker was writing and saying, well, it actually uses superhero conventions, I guess, which was a dig from The New Yorker. Although to me, I was like, well, that's probably a good idea. It makes a movie that people want to watch all the way through. But, you know, it's not an art piece the way that 12 Years a Slave was. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it functions more like a kind of like an action movie of revenge. But also it's triggering all of your outrage sensors and everything. But in order for anyone to experience it, they're going to have to go. And I don't think people want to go. There's enough ugliness in the world right now, and the ugliness of this Nate Parker story, people are just staring away.
Yeah, Joanna, you're a woman on the internet. You've witnessed kind of the conversation around Nate Parker. Do you feel like if it weren't for that scandal, this movie would have stood more of a chance? Or is it just a hard sell for a movie about a slave revolt no matter what?
No, I think the quote-unquote scandal definitely sunk it. Because I think those same people who would want to champion Birth of a Nation, and I'm not, you know, lumping Mike Hogan in with this, but the people who, like, really like to see a movie that they feel sort of politically righteous about, and I think Birth of a Nation sort of offered that opportunity, but that the Venn diagram of those people intersects exactly with the Venn diagram of people who just feel righteously against sexual assault. And the fact that this movie came out the day that the Trump tapes came out,
I think
only further exacerbated,
that's true.
It's just like a larger conversation that just keeps getting louder and louder. And the volume was cranked up big time on the date of the premiere.
And I think also kind of this week and last, when more people saw the film at screenings or at the theater, some really great writers like Kara Brown and Ira Madison, who are Black writers and, you know, write a lot about Black issues, saw the film and came down really hard on it. So I think that, like, within the community that in the movie's kind of grandest hope that they're sort of addressing and making this film for, there's a lot of strife about the movie there. So I think that maybe from Sundance, we all sort of overestimated the interest in this particular, not the story, certainly, but the film and the filmmaker.
So that's the first time that's ever happened at Sundance.
It's amazing.
It's a completely new phenomenon.
Well, that's the trouble with movies at Sundance, is you have, 9 months worth of buildup for when other people are going to see it. And there's no way to avoid the sense of overhype. I think me and Earl and the Dying Girl had this problem last year where it was this huge Sundance hit. And then by the time it opened in the summer, it was just fell like a stone. Like, nobody had the time of day for it. And you look at recent Best Picture nominees that did premiere at Sundance, they're quieter. Like, Boyhood was a Sundance hit. Mm-hmm. And Brooklyn was like a... But that wasn't even a Sundance hit. Like, Richard, you were saying you saw it at Sundance and people weren't even talking about it. And then it became a Best Picture nominee.
Yeah, it got some nice reviews, but that was kind of it. And then I think when it went to Toronto months later, that's when more people were like, oh, I think this is... Because it kind of fit better at that festival.
Yeah.
Beast of the Southern Wild kind of threaded the needle a little bit. But it wasn't... No one watched it and said, oh my God, we have our Best Picture.
Yeah.
Everybody said, wow, there's this weird movie that you got to see.
It was a scrappy underdog.
And it ended up, being enough for an 8 or 9 slot in Best Picture.
And that's kind of what Boyhood... I mean, Boyhood was more of a front runner, but it was also kind of an underdog. Like, you really wanted to pull for it. And
yes.
Birth of a Nation had all this weight of history and fixing racism on it. Like, it had more weight on it than any film could handle, much less one that's this flawed.
I think there's still, though, I was thinking about Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl as the buzzed hit last year that fell flat. And there is still, of course, that benefit of being the buzzy breakout from Sundance, even if you don't wind up cleaning up at the box office. Like, the cast of Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, Olivia Cooke, these other actors are getting these auditions that they never would have gotten, because in that industry-focused festival atmosphere, they were the most talked about thing. And so even if Birth of a Nation hadn't landed well, I think Nate Parker would have gotten more opportunities were he not now sort of smeared
toxic
by this. Yeah, this event.
Yeah, this is a unique case in terms of the things that have emerged. By the way, there is a Boyhood from this year's Sundance, and it's Manchester by the Sea.
Ah, yeah. You're a big drum beat for this one.
I am going to start beating the drum. Yeah. This is exactly the kind of movie I'd beat the drum about. Usually it ends in
heartbreak.
Deep disappointment and heartbreak. But I
Much
think
like
that
the movie.
Yeah. But I think that's a film that came out with buzz, but not with this kind of deafening, like, oh, cancel Oscar season.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be very surprised if it didn't come in with a Best Picture nomination and a bunch of other stuff.
I think the other thing about that compared to Boyhood also is that, like, Richard Linklater and Kenneth Lonergan coming out with good films at Sundance, it's like, well, sure, we expected those
right
to be good.
Yes.
It really, when it's a first-time filmmaker or a second-time filmmaker, that's when you get the excitement thing, and that creates that sort of Sundance fervor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's maybe a little unfair to a movie like Manchester, because it's like this beautifully made, and probably maybe it deserved a little bit more kind of excitement back in January, but it's getting it now. So.
But you're right, it's not a discovery where everyone drops everything and runs to see it.
Yeah,
who
exactly
is this kid? And let's give him, you know, 18 million or whatever.
It was already on everyone's schedule.
Right.
You know.
Yes. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's valid.
Yeah, I feel like we keep seeing the danger of that who is this kid drop everything hype at Sundance because it backfires so often compared to when it works. I mean, Nate Parker, again, is a really unusual case. But then you get people who, you know, have a Sundance hit and then get thrown up to direct some huge movie, like Mark Webb, who was given the Spider-Man franchise after 500 Days of Summer, and those movies were fine, but they faltered, and it almost feels like it hurt his career at this point. It's that hype machine can really go overboard.
Yeah, there's something very screwed up about Hollywood's thing of like, oh, there's a white guy who made a movie, let's give him a giant superhero franchise, although they seem to be trying to correct that a little bit.
Well, the most successful current example is Ryan Coogler, who had Fruitvale Station at Sundance and then made Creed, and now is making a Marvel movie, right? I'm not making that up. Yeah, so it's working for a non-white guy for once.
Yeah, But
he had Creed in between.
That has an intermediate. Yeah, that has like an intermediate step versus, I mean, it's silly to talk about Trevorrow as if he's not successful since Jurassic World made a gajillion dollars, but I think there are people who look at that film and don't see the technique that Spielberg saw when he plucked him, do you know? So
Well, meanwhile, Ben Zeitlin, director of Beasts of the Southern Wild, has yet to make his second film, so maybe he's cracked
the
code.
What is he doing?
He's been in Louisiana building weird stuff,
you?
As far as I know.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I mean, I think he's going to emerge with another movie eventually, and it'll probably be just as surprising as Weird of Beasts of the Southern Wild, and maybe that's the way to go.
So yeah, that
live
could
in the
be
swamp
it.
And make what you want and don't mm-hmm.
You don't
Hollywood.
Get updates about him from your Wesleyan newsletter?
I should be getting it from the Wesleyan newsletter.
There'll be a great New Yorker profile of him in about 40 years.
Yeah, yeah, and right. then I'll right. feel just as unaccomplished as I do. Having been in the same college.
The whole universe depends on everything fitting together just right. If one piece busts, even the smallest piece, the entire universe would get busted.
Here is an aurochs, a fierce creature.
The storm's coming!
Y'all better learn how to survive.
I'm your daddy. It's just my job to take care of you.
Okay?
So I'm intensely jealous of Joanna and Mike, both of whom recently caught La La Land thanks to the festival circuit. It's probably my most anticipated movie of the fall at this point. And Richard, you saw it earlier in Toronto, so I'm really jealous of all three of you. And I want to mostly just hear about all the dance numbers, but it feels like Emma Stone is the kind of most interesting conversation of the fall to me because she's got this huge, great lead performance in it. And it made me want to talk generally about Best Actress. But first, guys, tell me, does she have it locked up? Is Emma Stone just going to win the Oscar and it's over?
Not necessarily, because we got to also talk about Annette Bening. And then there's this Viola Davis thing just hanging over everybody like a sword of Damocles. I don't know why everyone just kind of says, like, Viola's winning. Shut up. So there's that possibility. But she's really, really great.
Yeah.
There's an amazing scene, and Richard and Joanna can maybe back me up, where she's in an audition.
Yeah.
And you get lost in this performance that she's doing in this audition. And they do this incredibly cruel thing where the assistant is in the back tapping on the door with a post-it. And the person's like, come in. And I'll be done in 2 minutes. And you're taken out of this thing. And so it's operating incredibly effectively on two levels. Really hard to do. She does a lot of like single take auditioning in ways that make you feel for her. So that alone, I think, is very cool. I don't know that she has a full-on breakdown. Neither does Annette Bening. We got to talk about this. There's not that full-on mucus coming out of the nose and mouth, you know, Best Actress scene.
The Halle Berry make me feel good moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's the only question I have.
Joanna, how about you? Are you in love with this movie and her?
Yes, I'm in love with the movie. I was talking to Richard a little bit about this when I got out of seeing it, and I think we agree that it sags a little in the middle. And Katie, it might sag for you too, because that's where the least amount of dancing happens.
I need more dancing.
Right. That's really, there's like, they take a pause for human drama and then go back to the dancing. And I think in that moment, I mean, what I was most curious about coming out of it is like, why is everyone talking about Emma Stone rather than Ryan Gosling?
Oh.
And I don't think it's wrong to talk about Emma Stone, but like, what is it about the movie that so pushes Emma Stone forward and doesn't provide the same for Ryan Gosling? And I think it's that middle part. I think the script sort of lets him down in the middle. His character takes some leaps in motivation that don't quite make sense to me. Whereas I don't think script ever lets Emma Stone down. She's like intensely appealing and sympathetic throughout. And her final audition scene, which is a song, I think, though she doesn't have snot coming out of her nose, I think they made that joke at the Golden Globes a couple years ago about her big eyes. And I know that in Birdman, right, they digitally enhanced her eyes, but her eyeballs are enormous in that scene. And they just suck you in as she sings this beautiful song. And I was just like, yep, she could get the statue just for that.
Does
for
it
sure.
have the Silver Linings Playbook dilemma where it's got the ingenue kind of giving the big female performance and the male lead is there and steady, but no one notices him because she's so appealing?
I think that's
he's in service to her, mm-hmm. unquestionably. And I think that's probably right. You know, that's the story.
Yeah. I mean, he's fantastic. Like, especially when he's in like charm and comedy mode, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
Some of the drama stuff does not quite land for me, and we know Gosling is a great dramatic actor, but as a song and dance leading man, I'm just like, yes, please. And Channing Tatum is so jealous that he's not in this movie. So,
hey, his Splash remake is coming.
It's a little bit of an inversion of the old, you know, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers thing. I mean, he doesn't have to do it backwards in heels, but there's a lot of wonderful scenes, great dancing scenes between them, all that stuff. But I do think that it's her movie at the end of the day.
She gets that centerpiece thing toward the end. Where it's like, that's what the movie's about. So she gets to kind of perform the meaning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of cedes to her. And I mean, she sells it. I mean, when I saw it, I tell you what, like, you could just feel everyone in the room just sort of like agreeing with the movie at that point. Like, if there were any doubters, I don't think there were many, but like, everyone just like, okay. And then you start to hear the sniffles and the crying, you know, and then it was like, okay. And for me, that felt like a kind of a coronation moment for her.
Mm-hmm.
She has competition that we're going to talk about, but I don't know, man. That song at the end, that's tough to beat.
Yeah.
And then they follow that song with a freaking American in Paris Dream Ballet. Like, I was like, this is every musical thing that I could possibly want. I was so in the tank for this movie, you know, to begin with, because I'm such a huge musicals fan. The person sitting next to me, Vince Mancini of UpRocks, is not a musicals guy, and he was just shattered by the movie. That's the word he used, was shattered. He couldn't drive home. He was just completely floored. And this is kind of a guy with like a bro reputation. So I was like, okay, it hits the whole spectrum. It hits the like sappy Joannas and like, you know, the bro Evinces. And this has a pretty good endorsement.
Well, it's incredibly romantic in a way that kind of sneaks up on you a little bit, you know, because there is the overt romantic, like full on references to MGM musicals and everything. But a lot of it's shot like a contemporary realist film. Mm-hmm. It's very clearly real Los Angeles. You know, I spent a fair amount of time in Los Angeles and kept being like, oh, I know that place. Oh, I've been there, you know. and so it's really what it's like to be in Los Angeles, except that the whole story is this classic fantasy of like following your dreams and never give up on your dream. That's the kind of point the movie makes. It's nice. It really, like, by the end of it, you're like, man, that is like a nice worldview. It's just a good place to visit, even with the sad parts of it. And I think that in a year like this, it might very much be a great antidote to the crap that we've all been enduring.
I certainly don't want to ruin this movie for anyone, but I will say that it's saved from being sappy by a healthy amount of poignancy, you know, throughout. It really could have been too cute, which, you know, the likes of 500 Days of Summer or whatever gets accused of, but that film has poignancy too. Like, I think that's a really key blue note to sort of balance the uplifting message of following your dreams. And I was really impressed by
blue note. Good jazz reference.
Is this the start of something wonderful and new? Or one more dream that I cannot make true?
Okay, so we referenced Annette Bening at the beginning of this conversation. She's in 20th Century Women, which premiered at the New York Film Festival over the weekend. Annette Bening has famously lost out on an Oscar twice to the same ingenue, Hilary Swank. Is this going to be another year where some young upstart takes Annette Bening's Oscar away?
I don't know, man. It might be.
Probably.
She's so good in it, though. I mean, I think there is still some question about whether she'll be in supporting or not. I can't imagine.
Set this movie up for me. The kid is the lead, the boy?
So the movie is Mike Mills directed and wrote, I think, semi-autobiographical in parts movie about a teenage boy, 15-year-old kid in 1979 Santa Barbara. His mother, who had him when she was a little bit older, I think about 40, so she's in her mid-50s, played by Annette Bening. They're in this great kind of half-crumbling, half-being-repaired mansion in Santa Barbara where they have two tenants, played by Greta Gerwig and Billy Crudup. Mm. And so it's kind of just coming of age. Elle Fanning is kind of the friend, love interest character. But she's given depth and agency. And it's just a really well done movie.
Well, my joke is this movie fails the Bechdel test in the most feminist ways possible.
Yes,
it's got to be intentional. All the women are frequently talking about the 15-year-old boy.
Uh-huh.
But it's basically like, how are we going to fix this kid and make sure he's not like another fuck up like all the other men, you know, since he doesn't have a dad. And Annette Bening's character... I've never seen anybody like that before on screen, I feel like. It's like a new character for me, and yet relatable and reminded me of my own mom and in other ways. You know, she's this very idealistic, but also 70s person, but also child of the Depression. So a big part of the film is her difficulty in kind of accessing her feelings or being honest about her feelings about her life. Which is a subtle thing to make a movie about, you know, like how hard for a kid to kind of relate to his older mom, loving her, but being frustrated and being 15. It does kind of meander. There's not a thread pulling this movie forward. It's the same amount of time as La La Land, but takes longer to get there. But you really feel like you're in this world. And really get to know this character in a really rich way. So,
well, you think
about
Mike Mills' previous movie, Beginners, which won Christopher Plummer an Oscar. He's playing the father in this movie. I think that was also semi-autobiographical. So, when Mike Mills runs out of parents, I don't know what he's going to do with his career.
Yeah.
But that movie's also about
music videos.
It's also about complicated internal things, and it was really well accomplished, including with a dog who had thoughts. So, you know, he's obviously proven he can do this.
Yeah.
I mean, he can. And I think, you know, the movie will have, I mean, it was resonant for me. My father was 49 when I was born. And so I know what the experience of having an older parent and kind of having that huge generational gulf. And, you know, so I think it works on that level. It works, I think, for anybody who's ever been a teenager, whether they're boy or girl, gay or straight, whatever. If you can tap into the movie's kind of subtle rhythms and themes, it works. It actually is really, I think, affecting. And I think that a performance like Bening's and like Greta Gerwig's really help you kind of shepherd you into the mood of the, because you want to kind of get to know Annette Bening's character more and more and more as the film goes, because she's so good at building kind of piece by piece this person.
She's kind of awe-inspiring. She's just this
figure,
incredible
this
figure. Yeah.
Kind of like Annette Bening in real life, where you kind of look at her and she's this icon, and married to Warren Beatty, she seems to have it
but
all figured
this,
out.
But this version is much more vulnerable, you know, but won't let you in, but you can tell, you know, she's I don't know. It's a fascinating character. It's really well done. But yeah, I think compared to Beginners, he, as usual for a follow-up film, he's bit off a lot more than he did with Beginners, I think. It's a bigger cast, more sprawling kind of story.
Yeah, it has like socioeconomic sprawl to it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's about time and place.
He really recreated Santa Barbara in 1979 in a very kind of large way.
Yeah.
So I think that for that reason, it's a little bit of a trickier play than Beginners, which was very just kind of straightforward.
But Beginners had the really gay angle, let's be honest. I mean, you know, like Christopher Plummer playing an old gay man. Like, that's...
Right, it's a hook. There's a hook that you get, and this one's harder to explain.
Anyway, we talk about, like, a complicated indie with a lot of emotions, and then, like, a big glossy musical that's, like, all about a love letter to Hollywood. It really feels like a David and Goliath. I mean, it's not just La La Land and 20th Century Women, but, you know, in terms of Oscar friendliness, like, one of them obviously has an edge.
But both really capture California in a way that feels very sort of real.
Yeah, and Academy friendly.
Yes.
Yeah, we know those Oscar voters love seeing California.
Right. I mean,
it's the best state, guys.
Yeah. I mean, Mike Mills, his aesthetic sense is just absolutely flawless. It's unbelievable. I mean, the whole thing is so gorgeous to look at and fun to look at if you're tuned into that frequency.
So to look real quickly at the rest of the Best Actress field, I think it really is a strong year. It's crazy to me that we've had this conversation about Best Actress, and Natalie Portman's playing Jackie O in a biopic that everyone loves, and she's like in third or fourth place, apparently. Like, how is this even possible?
Right, I didn't even bring her up before.
Yeah, I mean, it's a stacked year, and, you know, I think the reason that Natalie Portman isn't more in the conversation well, not that many people have seen the movie yet, but also...
This is Jackie that we're talking about.
Oh, sorry,
about.
Yeah. People saw it at Toronto. Also, she won 6 years ago. You know, I feel like there's not this kind of, like, anticipation for her, as because it's like, oh, yeah, we, you know, she's great, and we'll, you know, she'll be fine, because she already has her.
You don't need to prove that you love her.
But I don't know. I mean, it's screening at kind of a secret screening tomorrow at the New York Film, so it'll be today when
Thursday.
This podcast airs at the New York Film Festival. So the reaction there could be, we'll see, but I think it's
going
to be good.
I'm going, so we can talk about it next week.
It would be amazing, though, because Natalie Portman won her Oscar for Black Swan. She was very pregnant, and she's pregnant again, so she won two Oscars, both of which very pregnant. Just, you know,
we already talked about this, Katie, while you were on maternity leave. Now you've been revealed that you didn't listen to the episode while you were out.
I just want more pregnant people in pop culture. It's,
you are busted.
Representation. Yeah. So you guys have all seen more movies than I have. Anyone else in the Best Actress hunt that you're pulling for or want to see us talk about?
Joanna, did you see anything at your festival this past weekend that it jumped out?
Not in terms of Best Actress, no. I think when we talk about Best Supporting Actress, I have a few things to say. But no, other than Emma Stone, I don't think, you know, I saw Patterson, which is not Best Actress movie. And
unless that dog is a girl.
Right. And then I'm seeing the bulk of the rest of the films this week, so... Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Emma Stone was there at the La La Land screening that I saw, and it was so interesting to me because I've seen a lot. You know, I saw Brie Larson at that festival last year right before she won Best Actress, and she was very much already in working it mode, which we've all talked about in terms of we love Brie Larson. We think she's very talented, but we also think she ran a very precise Oscar campaign.
That's almost everyone who wins, especially in Best Actress, does it. You know, it's hard to do it by accident.
Right. Whereas Emma Stone was sort of standing in front of the theater. She didn't take her coat off. She sort of was not looking at the audience. She had like a fringe of hair in front of her face. And she was sort of like quietly answering questions. And she, you know, perfectly lovely, but not in working it mode at all. So I'll be curious to see like if when this campaign picks up steam, what we'll see from her. Because she doesn't strike me as a very working it kind of actress. You know, like she and Andrew Garfield famously pulled tricks on paparazzi and stuff like that. Like, she seems a very private person. So I'll be intrigued to see what happens in the next few months with that.
Someone who is not a stranger to kind of working that campaign is Amy Adams, who, is fantastic in Arrival and a movie that, you know, has not come out yet. But the more and more people see it, I think it was just at the London Film Festival and it got a lot of raves,
it's really
there.
Good.
So I think that could, we should never count her out. That would be her sixth nomination, I think.
Wow.
In 10 years, which is a crazy amount. She did a Q&A at Telluride at, you know, 8:30 at night. And then did another one at 9 in the morning, having just gotten into Telluride at 4 in the morning the day before. She's committed. Like, she commits to these projects and wants to support them. So I think that's a real asset, you know, for that movie and for her. But, you know, again, this is such a crowded year and I think that performance is kind of recessive and small.
And I feel like there's almost a sense that, like, Amy Adams will win her Oscar. Like, she keeps giving great performances.
So.
She keeps getting nominated. Yeah. Everyone, like, is like, oh, we can put her off for another year. But, you know, that can happen, and then you never get nominated again, and then it's over. So you don't want to let the opportunity to give Amy Adams her Oscar slip away.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to see Emma Stone working it, watch the video from Toronto of Krista interviewing her and Ryan Gosling, because she rose for two in that one. Because Gosling is hilarious, but doing press is like he's allergic to it. So she was kind of covering for both.
So it's like the Anne Hathaway and James Franco Oscars of video interviews.
You know, it's back to Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the classic one when they're doing press together. She's doing it for both of them backwards and in heels.
I won't dance. Don't ask me. I won't dance. Don't ask me, I won't dance, madam, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should do.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about Best Supporting Actress, since, Joanna, you said you had a lot of contenders. So to go big before we go home, who's going to win Best Supporting Actress, guys? Joanna, you can go first.
You know what? This is going to sound silly, I guess, but I'm going to say Michelle Williams for Manchester by the Sea.
Not silly.
Like, if you want to talk about like the snot coming out of your nose sort of actress performance, which we've seen Michelle Williams do, this is a classic one. It also has an accent on top of it. But, you know, like Michelle Williams, I just think I think she has the ability to tap really deep into vulnerability in a way in this film. It's very appealing to me. So that would be my vote.
Richard?
I like Joanna's vote, but based on this weekend and my own sort of love for her movies past, Greta Gerwig in 20th Century Women. I think it's so good. I think that would be a real kind of like anointing performance, like kind of award for her being like, okay, kid, you're finally in the club after being in indies for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I think she has a better shot of winning than Benning does as a kind of representative for this nice little movie. Kind of the way Plummer won for supporting for
hey.
Right.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And she's also in Jackie.
She's a tiny part in Jackie, okay. But yeah, she is in Jackie. So she has that kind of a little, you know, added, bumped up profile.
She'll be at twice as many cocktail parties to
there
meet
you go.
Voters.
That's exactly
I mean,
right.
Yeah.
What about Elle? What about Elle Fanning in 20th Century?
I mean, she's been simmering.
You know what it is? If you've ever met Elle Fanning, she's like the bubbliest person alive. It's hilarious.
Oh, really?
And so with that in mind, watching that performance, I was like, man, she's really acting her ass off because this is like one cranky kid in that movie. I thought she was really good. They're both, but yeah, Greta Gerwig has more, a little more shading.
I just feel like it's her
they're
kind of
great.
Opening up to the world in a way. I mean, Frances Ha was good, but this is like a little bit more mainstream and it's just like, here she is. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, she figured it out. So.
Yeah, and not in full Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Not at all.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. All right, Mike, what do you think?
Manic Panic Dream Girl.
Manic Panic. Yeah,
oh,
because she does.
Thank you.
Hair,
that was very
right?
good, Mike.
Trying to keep up with the Blue Note thing
sort of
from earlier. Yeah. I don't know. Everyone always takes my pick. I kind of think Michelle Williams. I just, I don't know.
Yeah, you have Manchester.
Know. I really fell for that movie and that scene where she's—I don't want to spoil it—but there's quite an extraordinary scene toward the end.
I mean,
sings a song. It's really weird.
She sings a song during an audition with a Boston accent.
No one does devastating emotion like Michelle Williams on film.
Yeah, she gives the whole array here. I don't know, man. It's really good. I don't know if she's going to campaign or what, but man.
Hey, what's interesting is she and Emma Stone were both in Cabaret. I think Michelle took over for Emma and Sally Bowles. So back on the Oscar
right.
circuit together.
Oh.
Opposite the Sally Bowles curse, the Sally Bowles blessing.
me having seen very little, I'm going to go with a real wild card. Kristen Stewart's in Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And I think she's overdue for an Oscar nomination, which is crazy, given that like 4 years ago, everyone thought she was just the girl from Twilight. But if she's good in it, no one's seen it yet, as far as I know.
No.
We're going Friday.
Yeah. So you guys can prove me wrong in a week. But it seems like if she could get nominated and, you know, if it's a big enough role, like she's like right at work, well, not in the same way as Greta Gerwig, but she's kind of ready for her leap up into the big Oscar consideration after a career that's kind of taken her in a lot of different directions.
I would be thrilled with that.
I love her so much.
Yeah. Everyone does. Like, and it's gone from being like, oh, she only just like tosses her hair and stares at vampires to being an incredibly dynamic, fascinating actress.
Yeah. Two critics, I forget who exactly, like after they saw Personal Shopper at New York Film Festival, were like, Kristen Stewart is the best actress of her generation. And it's like, that is such a huge change from just a few years ago.
Yeah.
So it's
is
been
Personal
fun to
Shopper
watch.
Out this fall?
No. Those Essayas movies usually premiere in the spring.
Yes.
So it'll be out in like
March. But Clouds of Sils Maria got a ton of attention award season regardless.
Well,
so.
And she won whatever that crazy
Cesar
Award.
Yeah.
I always think of her not as Twilight, but as the crazy gypsy kid from Into the Wild. So that's my context for her great acting. It's not even surprising.
No one goes to Panic Room.
I was going to say Panic Room.
Yeah.
So a lot of interesting actresses coming up to the front this season. It's going to be
stacked.
Fun. Yeah. And that does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening. And if you can, rate and review us on iTunes. We appreciate it. And it helps us find new listeners as this Oscar season gets going. You can find us all writing about award season and other stuff at vanityfair.com. And we're on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And Mike?
Mike_Hogan, but don't even look because it's all just Trump stuff. I just don't even go there for a month.
Anti-Trump stuff.
Anti-Trump stuff.
Give you three more weeks to get back down to ground level. Joanna, how about you?
Joe wrote this. Also a lot of anti-Trump stuff.
Yeah, and Westworld stuff, if you're into Westworld. This episode was edited and produced by Alana Milner, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Annie Bowers at Panoply. And the award for best defense of Donald Trump sniffles goes to Mike Hogan.
There's not that full-on mucus coming out of the nose and mouth.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.